Your lecturer is Dr. Elizabeth A. Murray. Dr. Murray is a forensic anthropologist, an award-winning professor, and an instructor for numerous professional organizations, including the U.S. Department of Justice and the International Association of Coroners and Medical Examiners. She served as a consultant and on-screen personality for the National Geographic Channel's Skeleton Crew, and has appeared on America's Most Wanted and Forensic Files. Her book, Death, Corpses, Cadavers, and Other Grave Matters, was named one of the 2011 Top Summer Reads for Students by the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Outside of any personal experience, how do we know what we know about crime and the methods employed to solve it? As long as there's been written language, historians have recorded landmark events, especially surrounding the lives and deaths of some famous people. In some cases, other people became famous because something unusual, either tragic or extraordinary, happened in their lives and was written down for posterity in our history books. This includes those who broke the laws of society, the unfortunate victims of crime, as well as those whose work helps seek justice. I'm Beth Murray, and I'm here to take you on a journey through history by focusing on some compelling forensic cases, both famous and not so famous, including a few of my own. I've been a practicing forensic scientist, specifically a forensic anthropologist, for nearly 30 years. I like to say I was forensic before it was cool. But I'm also quite a history buff, and I love a great story, thanks to my father. So this is a wonderful opportunity for me to blend those interests and focus on what I hope you'll agree are some fascinating cases. Together, we'll re-examine some of the world's most notorious crimes, and at times consider how they might be investigated had they happened today. We'll also see how modern forensic techniques have uncovered fresh or unexplored evidence and used it to reanalyze old cases, shedding new light on what we thought we knew. And in some lectures, we'll look at more recent forensic matters to see how far we've come fighting crime. Along the way, you'll learn a little bit about the history of forensic science, too. Today, much of our knowledge of crime, criminals, their victims, and forensics comes from the media, which of course is a form of recorded history. So do you have any idea what's considered by many to be the landmark case for crime reporting? The forensic evidence and investigation in this case created the first known major media crime sensation, which started locally then spread across much of the world. It's a forensic analysis that began in the late 1880s and is still ongoing today. This case has spawned hundreds of theories, countless publications, and has had some of forensic science's greatest minds re-examine it. But despite all this effort, we still don't know the identity of the perpetrator. So he goes by the legendary name of Jack the Ripper. Although the exact number of victims is not really known, most authorities agree that five women killed between August 31st and November 9th of 1888 in the East London area known as Whitechapel are confidently the work of one serial killer. Many sources also attribute a sixth victim from earlier that August to Jack the Ripper. Some theories raise the number of victims to 11 women, and still other sources go even higher, perhaps including a 7-year-old boy, encompassing a larger group of attacks that took place in the same general vicinity between February 25th and December 29th of 1888. But the earlier assaults during this broader 10-month period seem more haphazard, and the victims were not killed. As a result, most scholars believe those are not connected, but rather just reflect the impoverished, dangerous, and crime-ridden East End of London at the time. It's also possible, though, that at least some of those earlier attacks were the more clumsy beginnings of a killing spree that Jack the Ripper ultimately mastered. Now, in addition to time, what other evidence has been used to connect some of these crimes? the reason most agree five female victims are definitively linked, and why some authorities insist others are decidedly not the work of the same killer, is what forensic scientists call modus operandi, or simply the perpetrator's MO. All these five women were prostitutes who lived and worked in the slums of the East End of London. So apparently part of the Ripper's MO was to prey upon women of the night, which is when all of these killings occurred. But no semen was discovered in any of these cases, which not only further links them, but also suggests that rape was not part of the MO. The murders are further connected by increasing brutality, showing an escalation of sorts as time went on, a phenomenon seen in the careers of many criminals. Investigators look at these same facets today when they suspect crimes might be linked. Victim choice, weapon use, level of brutality, escalation. Connecting similarities like these is really, in a way, just common sense. Much of forensic science analysis, at least within the mind of the investigator, is similar to what our brains do every day in countless situations: compare data and recognize patterns. As an example, let's look at the evidence used to connect the Whitechapel casualties in 1888. The definitive Ripper victims, known as the, quote, canonical five, are the cases agreed on by all accounts. All five were females whose poverty and love of alcohol apparently led them to prostitution. Their ages varied somewhat, but all were young to middle-aged, a range we'd assume typical for prostitutes. All were Caucasian, but that could be said of the entire neighborhood. The East End of London was rapidly becoming crowded with immigrants from Ireland, as well as Russian Jews, which resulted in economic downturn and social tension, as we'll see. But now, let's get to the crime scenes. The first of the canonical five, Marianne Nichols, also known as Polly, was discovered on August 31st. She was lying on her back with her skirts pulled up. Her throat was slashed deeply twice, all the way down to her vertebrae, and her lower abdomen had been cut several times. Some of those belly wounds were so deep they literally ripped open her body cavity, exposing her intestines. When a physician examined her remains at the scene at around 4 o'clock in the morning, he considered body temperature, as we would do today. Since her body and legs were still somewhat warm compared to her cold hands, he concluded Nichols was probably dead for about half an hour. The body of the second victim, Annie Chapman, was found around 6 o'clock on the morning of September 8th. She also had two extremely deep cuts to her throat, which a physician later said at the inquest had been made from left to right. I assume they thought this would perhaps reveal whether the perpetrator was behind the victim or in front of her. But that would also depend on whether he was left or right-handed. Now, Chapman's skirts had been raised, and this time, not only was her belly cut open, but her intestines were pulled outside her body, and her uterus had been removed and was missing. This is what forensic investigators call taking a trophy. Chapman's autopsy also showed bruises that the doctor knew must have come from a previous altercation. Bruising doesn't happen at or after death, since once the heart stops beating, blood pressure no longer drives the circulation that pushes blood out of broken vessels and into tissues. Dead skin lacks what's known as a vital reaction. Later, witnesses described seeing Annie in a bar fight earlier in the week, substantiating the antemortem bruises. Anyway, the MO made it far more logical to link this killing to the same vicious perpetrator who had murdered Marianne Nichols just a week before, not suspect that it was the fallout from a barroom brawl. Almost a month later, on September 30th, the body of Elizabeth Stride was found at around 1 o'clock in the morning. But this case was different. The victim had only one cut to her neck, her skirts weren't raised, and her belly wasn't mutilated. So why did police connect her to these other murders? Several witnesses claimed to have seen Stride in the area between around 11 p.m. and 12:45 on the same night she was murdered, and in the company of a man. One witness told police the couple was kissing in the recessed doorway of a building, and that he heard the man say to Stride, "You would say anything but your prayers." Another witness who claimed to have seen Stride about 12:30 a.m. was a young police constable who said the man with her carried a package about 18 inches long wrapped in newspaper. So eyewitnesses are, without fail, a big lead for investigators, right? Well, not always. In this case, there were numerous people willing to say they saw a couple in the area that evening, or at least saw Elizabeth Stride with a man. But few of them could agree on the appearance of the guy they claimed to have seen, or the clothing he was wearing. And eyewitness testimony can be notoriously unreliable. Plus, there's the well-known phenomenon of people falsely reporting events to get attention or to jump on the media frenzy bandwagon around incidents like this. But one eyewitness said he saw Stride at 12:45 a.m. in the same location where her body was found in an altercation with a man. The witness said the man had dark hair, a thin mustache, was about 5 feet 5 inches tall, broad-shouldered, and around 30 years old. Now, this was fairly consistent with the description of the man made by the police constable. The onlooker thought he was watching a domestic argument, and he didn't want to get involved, especially after the attacker took notice of the witness, so the bystander decided to just keep on moving. We've all heard of cases in the news in which people don't want to get involved. Or maybe they only realize the gravity of what they saw after they hear later that they witnessed a crime. The discovery of Elizabeth's body just 15 minutes after this man saw what he thought was a domestic dispute suggested the witness, who was a Hungarian Jew and had to be interviewed through an interpreter, may not have only seen Jack the Ripper, but actually stumbled upon him in the process of killing one of his victims. Authorities took the account of this Hungarian quite seriously for two main reasons. First, the witness came forward despite significant anti-Semitic tensions in the area. Second, he saw what he described as an altercation, including the woman's very low-pitched cry before the attacker noticed the bystander causing the Hungarian to rush off. Investigators already believed that the Ripper's MO was to strangle or slit his victim's throats, cutting them twice so deeply that their airway was cut, disabling them from screaming during the rest of the attack. Now, police theorized that the Hungarian may have stumbled upon the attacker as he was just beginning to execute his typical MO on Stride. But once the Ripper realized someone was watching, he ran off after only a single cut to the victim's neck, abandoning the rest of his standard mutilation. An examination of Stride's body in the courtyard where she lay showed the cut in her neck was so deep that there was a spray of blood extending some distance from her body. Today's blood spatter analysis wasn't standard protocol at that time, but my read of that jet of blood sounds like a major artery was cut, causing the force of the heart to send the blood quite a distance away. An officer on the scene said the woman's face was still warm, corroborating her recent death. Within moments of the discovery of Stride's body, as people began shouting in the streets that yet another murder had taken place, a crowd of nearly 30 people had gathered around. This prompted an officer to tell them to stand back. Now, he didn't seem as concerned about them contaminating the crime scene with their own trace evidence as we would today, but rather he told them if they got blood on their clothes, they might be suspect. In fact, officers examined the hands and clothes of onlookers for blood stains, just as might be done today. Investigators took names and addresses and even checked people's pockets before allowing anyone to leave. Stride's clothing was in place from head to toe with one exception. The bow that had tied her scarf was askew, as though the perpetrator had used it to grab her from behind. A doctor at the scene estimated the time of death at around 20 to 30 minutes prior. Based on the depth of the cut to the victim's neck, he said she would have bled to death in a minute and a half or so. Pretty sophisticated for 1888, isn't it? Keep in mind, though, that most common people were familiar with slaughtering animals, and a standard method was cutting the major vessels of the neck to bleed them to death. Now, why else connect Stride with the Ripper? What might a serial killer do if he's built up a frenzy but then been thwarted? Well, about 45 minutes after the discovery of Stride's remains, the body of Catherine Eddowes was found not too far away. In a stroke of unbelievably bad fortune, Eddowes had been in jail that night for being drunk and disorderly. And she was released about 1 o'clock that morning, around the same time Stride was being murdered. If the Ripper couldn't complete his full MO on Stride, he quickly did so on Eddowes to satisfy himself. She had her throat slit twice, her skirts lifted, her belly cut open from nearly her navel to her rectum, and portions of her intestines removed and placed up on her shoulder. This time, in addition to most of her uterus being cut out, her left kidney was also removed and taken as a trophy. Her face was cut up too, including one ear. Investigators later found a piece of cloth smeared with both blood and feces not too far from the crime scene. The cloth turned out to be part of Eddowes' apron that the killer had cut from her clothing and then apparently used to clean his knife and possibly his hands. Had that happened today, perhaps DNA from somebody other than Eddowes might have been found on that fabric, especially if the perpetrator had used it to wipe off his hands. But when you consider how infrequently people likely washed their clothing in those days, well, the analysis would certainly have been complicated. Besides, without a suspect, whose DNA would be gathered for a comparison sample? Minimally, though, the victims could have been definitively linked if the same DNA profile was found in each case, even if the owner of that DNA was not known. Another unusual aspect of the Eddowes case was a message neatly written in chalk on the wall in the busy marketplace right next to where the piece of apron had been discarded. It said, quote, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing," end quote. The meaning of this message is still open to debate and interpretation, but it echoed the anti-Semitism that was dividing the community with regard to the murders. Terror in society often stirs up wild emotions, including the desire to blame and demonize some group or some person. And as we've seen throughout history, we most often point the finger at those who are not like us. How would evidence like a chalk-written message on a building entryway be captured? It should have been saved then, as it would be today, using forensic photography. Photography was well established by then, and there are many images related to the Ripper murders available, including morgue photos of victims. But unbelievably, because of the darkness of the early morning hour, the wait time for the arrival of a photographer, and the fact that the shop owners were beginning to open up their market stalls, the police decided instead to just copy down the writing and then obliterated the message at 5:30 in the morning. They feared if crowds saw the message, there would be a riot against the Jewish community and more lives might be lost. While I can certainly understand their anxiety, destroying potential handwritten evidence like that leaves me shaking my head. Many Ripper scholars believe, though, that the graffiti may have already been there, especially since some observers said it was blurry. And it may have been a complete coincidence that the piece of Eddowes' apron was dropped in the same location. Either way, there was heavy criticism of the police decision to eradicate that message. Another interesting forensic aspect related to this writing was the early use of forensic linguistics. That's the study of language. Based on the spelling and grammatical errors, the police commissioner felt strongly the graffiti did not come from a native English speaker. He wrote in his report, quote, "The idiom does not appear to be English, French, or German, but it might possibly be that of an Irishman speaking a foreign language. It seems to be the idiom of Spain or Italy," end quote. Given the odd phrasing, this makes complete sense. But it's interesting to note the use of language to help profile the suspect. The nonsensical nature of the wording led authorities to two possible conclusions if the killer actually wrote it. Jack the Ripper was Jewish and bragging of it, or the killer was trying to thwart the investigation by blaming a Jew. Now, what about other police profiling of the likely killer? Well, due to the anatomical knowledge some ascribe to the mutilations and the trophy removal, and the allegations that the Ripper may be a Jew, some began to suspect the killer was a Jewish slaughterhouse worker. So perhaps to help satisfy the public, the police rounded up the knives of the local Jewish slaughterman to see if any matched the suspected weapon. A doctor concluded that none of them seemed to be the murder weapon. So we see evidence of early attempts to match a sharp tool with a wound, something common in forensics today, including in my own work, although typically far more reliable when analyzing trauma to bone rather than soft tissue. Nearly 2 weeks after the night Stride and Eddowes were killed, the chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee got a package containing half a kidney. It was preserved in wine and assumed to be human. Along with this was a note full of spelling errors that explained the other half had been eaten by the killer. We'll talk about notes attributed to the Ripper in a few minutes. But with regard to the kidney, how could forensic science establish this organ as belonging to a human? Well, based on my many years of teaching anatomy, using both human and non-human organs for dissection and microscopy, I can tell you that a pig kidney, or that of any similar-sized animal, is very like that of a human. Today's DNA testing, as well as much faster antibody testing, could allow investigators to fairly quickly determine the animal source, although I have no idea how pickling an organ in wine might affect those tests. But the best they could do in 1888 was a microscopic examination, something commonly done in autopsies today to look for pathology, but not to try to figure out the species. Now, two doctors independently verified the kidney was human, but based on the portion they had, the doctors were not specifically able to match it to Eddowes' body at her truncated renal artery, so they couldn't say for certain it was her missing kidney, but they also couldn't prove it wasn't. Now, despite the rapid succession of four victims in the month between August 31st and September 30th, the last of the Ripper Five, Mary Jane Kelly, was not killed until November 9th, almost 6 weeks later. Kelly's also the only one of the canonical five murdered indoors. She lived in a multiple-unit building, and two neighbors claimed to have heard a woman cry out murder once at around 4 o'clock. But said the building was always fairly noisy. A man sent by the landlord to collect some overdue rent that morning found Kelly's body around 10:45. After knocking and then peering through the window, he was stunned to see Kelly's mutilated body on the bed and pieces of flesh lying on a table near the window. He ran to get his boss. Then the landlord sent his man on to the police station. This time, the scene investigation seemed much more thought out, perhaps due to criticism of the previous actions. Police sent a telegram to Scotland Yard to bring in the bloodhounds, since the crime scene hadn't been disturbed. The area was cordoned off to the public. No one was allowed to either enter or leave, and a doctor was called in. Because the door was locked, which is curious to me, but I don't know how the door lock worked, the doctor looked through the window, and he immediately realized there was nothing he could do for the victim. So they waited for the dogs. But for some reason, the decision to use the dogs was reversed. And at 1:20 in the afternoon, police broke down the door and began to examine the murder scene. This time, crime scene photos were taken. They're available, and they're really awful. Kelly's body was on the bed, nude, with her legs splayed open. Her face had been mutilated beyond recognition, with parts of her nose, cheeks, eyebrows, and ears removed. Kelly's throat was cut to her spine, her abdomen completely eviscerated of its organs, which were found in various places on the bed. Her heart had been cut out and was never recovered. Pieces of skin and flesh had been removed from her thighs down to the bone, as well as from her abdomen, and her breasts were excised. As I mentioned before, some of her tissue was piled on a table near the window. This shows the escalation of the Ripper's actions, or maybe he just had more time and privacy since he was inside. Investigators noticed the fireplace was still warm and found a large quantity of women's clothes that had been burned, perhaps to give the killer light by which to work, since there was only one candle in the room. They searched for evidence of anything unusual and found a man's pipe, but it ended up belonging to Kelly's boyfriend. Police padlocked the door to a room to protect the scene in case they wanted later to re-examine things. And although they lack the technology we have today, investigators did consider some of the same things we do now. What's present and what's absent at the scene? What assumptions might we derive from that evidence? Later that day, Kelly's body was autopsied. There were so many cuts to the victim's neck that investigators couldn't establish the direction of the weapon's path. Because rigor mortis was setting in, the attending physicians estimated the time of Kelly's death at somewhere between 2 and 8 that morning. They believed it might have taken the Ripper perhaps 2 hours to do that much damage to her body. But unlike earlier reports, their conclusion was that the killer did not have any anatomical knowledge based on the haphazard way the organs had been removed. They estimated the size of the blade used at 1 inch wide and about 6 inches long. Though today it's known that estimates of blade size from soft tissue wounds are notoriously difficult and unreliable. The murder of Mary Kelly apparently ended the killer's rampage, at least in the London Whitechapel area. No one knows to this day who he was or why the murders ended. Did he die? Was he incarcerated for something else? Did he wind up in a mental institution? Did he move away? Despite thousands of books written on the subject and countless articles espousing different theories and possible suspects, over 125 years of analysis, his identity is not known. Why was the Jack the Ripper case such a worldwide media sensation, even back in the 1880s? I mean, in addition to how horrific it was. Any idea why these murders are among the first to prompt what investigators call copycat killings? Why this case ultimately included a series of letters claiming to be from the murderer? This brings us to another major theme I hope you recognize throughout this course, and that's the continuous interplay between science and society. For example, how forensic advances in both crimes and the technology used to solve them are fairly directly correlated with other changes in society. The simple reason this series of brutal murders became the best-known criminal matter of its time was the concurrent boom in newspaper circulation in the second half of the 19th century. Advances in printing and tax reform in England allowed unprecedented low-cost newspaper production and distribution. And since London was arguably the most prominent of capital cities in the world at the time, it had dozens of newspapers. The Lancet, Times, Daily Telegraph, Daily News, Evening News, Standard, Star, Echo, Lloyd's Weekly, East London Observer, East London Advertiser, Jewish Chronicle, Jewish Standard, a whole host of others. Even one publication called the Illustrated Police News, which was an early type of true crime magazine. In addition to the newspaper industry, a big reason word of the Ripper's killings went worldwide so quickly was that this was also the time of advances in the telegraph technology, including intercontinental communications. The 19th century also witnessed many advances in photography. So in essence, the Ripper murders coincided with the era when modern journalism was born. So after the discovery of Polly Nichols' mutilated body, news of London's East End crime wave spread quickly. Newspapers across the globe picked up that story and the related ones that came with each killing. In fact, the infamous name of the still unknown killer was actually delivered to the newspapers. It came in the form of a letter written in red ink to London's Central News Agency organization on September 27th. That was between the second and third murders among the canonical five. The letter's author took credit for the prostitute killings, saying he would cut off the ears of the next victim, and was signed Jack the Ripper. Later, on October 1st, a postcard in the same red ink and handwriting was delivered to the news agency about the double event, alluding to the deaths of Elizabeth Stride and Kate Eddowes in the same night. Even saying that, quote, number one squealed a bit, couldn't finish straight off, had not the time to get ears for police. And if you remember, although Eddowes' ears were not removed, one was definitely cut. But then, as now, many who have delved into the Ripper murders believe the letter and the postcard were part of a hoax. Most attribute them to someone in the media, a journalist who had inside knowledge of the events and wanted to sell newspapers. And sell papers they did. In fact, Mary Jane Kelly's boyfriend told police she regularly asked him to read her the news of the killer from the local papers. Little could either one know that she would soon be front page news as the Ripper's final victim.